Campus FM presents a talk organized by Palazzo Falson entitled The Baroque House and the World Within. This talk is delivered by Dr. Therese Vella.
So the International Institute for Baroque Studies at the University of Malta is organizing a number of activities as part of an outreach program, which is being coordinated by Dr. Petra Bianchi and Caruana Tinkley, actually. And the idea is to disseminate knowledge about the Baroque heritage of the Maltese islands to as wide an audience as possible. Now, this outreach program actually has started last October, and a number of lectures have been organized. Today, this is the last of the lectures of this academic year, which is a lecture about the interior of Baroque houses. A great contrast, actually, to the interior where we are now, because this is a medieval interior. It's one of the oldest houses, actually, in Imdina, dating back to the 13th century or so. The lecturer is Dr. Teresa Bianchi, Dr. Teresa Vella, I'm sorry. And Teresa actually is a visiting lecturer in the Institute for Baroque Studies concerned with art, painting in particular. And apart from that, she is a museological consultant in the regeneration of the Palace in Valletta, am I right? So she, actually the palace is one of our most important, the most actually important Baroque residence in the Maltese Islands, built by the Grand Masters in the 16th century, but then decorated at different times during the Baroque period. So it is a very good example, actually, of a Baroque residence. I shall take no more of your time, actually, and I hope that you will enjoy this lecture. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor De Luca. Thank you to Palazzo Falzon for kindly inviting me to hold this lecture here, and for the Institute of Baroque Studies to invite me to form part of its outreach program. The subject today has evolved over a few years for me. It's something that I first touched upon in the course of my doctoral studies on the beginnings of art collecting in Malta, which really started with hospitalar art collections. But over time, I came to realize that collecting may well have started earlier, although it's less visible. And another area of interest that grew with my doctoral research was the display of collections, or paintings in particular. How did people display their collections? In the course of my research, I came across some fabulous lists of over 100, in one case 280 paintings on display in a palace. But short of these lists, what else do we know about the spaces that these paintings or these collections formed part of? So today I'm really hoping to start, if you like, a discussion about this relatively invisible subject, the spaces that people inhabited in the early modern age. Before I start, I should start with my acknowledgements, because they tend to be gotten over very quickly. This lecture wouldn't have happened had there not been the possibility of conversations and discussions with dear colleagues. Dr. Giovanni Bonello, my director, people like Francesca, Joan Abella, Stephen Spiteri. There's a very collegial environment that's growing in Malta amongst researchers, where we kind of swap bits and pieces and enjoy seeing then those little references cropping up in somebody else's lectures, as opposed to being terribly territorial about it. I also wish to thank Dr. David Tonna for giving me permission to take some photographs inside a historic house in Valletta, Palazzo Sitges, and Anne Maroma Camilleri for providing so many wonderful pictures from the archives of the Order of St. John. The history of Baroque houses really starts with the building of Valletta. We've had, and the history of Baroque houses is really bracketed by the arrival of St. John in Malta in 1530 and ends with their departure, 1798. because although in other spheres neoclassical tastes, more romantic tastes had started seeping in, within the hospitaller culture, we could say that the Baroque really kept a stronghold on the hospitaller imagination. Valletta is the site of some of the most magnificent Baroque buildings we have, and they've been very well discussed by architectural historians. Places like the Conventual Church of St. John, the palace itself starting to get a bit more attention, the churches, the glorious churches like St. James, St. Augustine's, and others. But it's been less easy to start discussing interiors of Baroque houses, homes, because after all, they're private, and one doesn't get access to houses as easily as one does, of course, to churches, or for that matter, offices that are occupying a lot of our Baroque houses these days. So, while facades have been also well discussed, and, you know, more names of architects are cropping up, coming in, very few historians have actually taken us inside the Baroque house. The Baroque home, is where the early modern person lived out his own private theatre of life, his or her own private theatre of life. We tend to think of the home as being very gendered, as being a woman's space, which in a way raises a question. Why do we know so little about it? Why do we know so little about women's role in the furnishing of houses? Or, a closer subject close to my subject, the role of women as patrons of art. It so happens that in Malta we have perhaps a particular situation where women very often had to take care of their husbands' businesses while their husbands were out at sea, for example. So nowadays, thanks to research being done in notarial archives especially, we now are starting to see a greater visibility being given to the role of women in daily life. Of course, we do know already quite a bit about women thanks to the Inquisition records, and there's a perhaps seamier side to the role of women in early modern life that started coming out. But still, those women who behaved, what visibility do they have? Well, hopefully this talk might trigger now a new interest in the spaces, in domestic spaces, or the domestic space of the Baroque house. Now, the Baroque house was really a theatre, I said the private theatre of one's own life. The main protagonists would be, for example, an elderly, very well-off knight, possibly living with his own cousins, or perhaps nephews or nieces living with him. We do know that they had family members living with them. It could be a professional person living in Valletta, architects, doctors, notaries with their spouses and their children, or other people, craftspersons, often lived in a sort of casa bottega type of arrangement. So that's really the space where home is part of one's work. But really, even with notarial work or with doctor's work, very often that's the home would be sort of that interim space between one's private life and the public life of the street. But certainly, the moment the early modern person walked in home, into his house, one would shed the rank, the hierarchy of class of one's public life, and sort of take on living within a new hierarchy, now the hierarchy of households. Because we do know, of course, as well, that while we know who the main protagonists, the main people living in houses were, they were then the backstage crew. Those were the servants who were busy cooking, taking care of the laundry, taking care of livestock, taking care of the maintenance. That helped to make early modern life just about bearable. But what are the sources of information that we do have to learn more about the Baroque interior space? We've got a gem of an archive in the archives of the Order of St. John. And there's this magnificent cabreo, a sort of pictorial inventory of houses that belong to the Order of St. John. Keep in mind that knights were allowed to purchase property and purchase belongings, and we know they had some fabulous, magnificent collections. But at their death, their belongings would then be ceded to the Order of St. John. Knights only had the right, hospitable knights only had the right of bequeathing up to one-fifth of the value of their belongings. The rest of the four-fifths were given to the Order of St. John. This goes some way towards explaining the notion of the vow of poverty that the knights took. They didn't actually own the property. They simply enjoyed it for the duration of their time while they were hospitaller knights. So we've got a magnificent album of drawings, watercolors really, showing the houses that were ceded to the Order of St. John. This is just one of them. And the really ingenious thing is that the way the person who compiled this album created a series of overlapping layers to show the different levels of, as we're seeing here, is the Piano della Cantina, and we can see the sheets, the slip of paper to the right, that will then be overlaid to show you the Piano Terreno, and then another one showing the Piano del Mezzanino, for example, or, and then finally, the Piano Nobile. So this is a very clever way, a sort of an early modern day AutoCAD, you could say, that allows anybody to be able to see even how the spaces relate to each other in terms of staircases. This album combines the drawing of the facade together with the drawing of the layout of the house itself. The facades themselves are very interesting, although we shall move in very slowly. But this is just to give you a bit of a sample of the type of architectural drawings that one finds in this gorgeous album of architectural plans. We've got Casa Coronia, other Prospetti della Casa. A lot of houses still exist, but some of them, like one that we are about to see, was unfortunately destroyed in the war, and that is Casa Correa, which is in the which was the site of today's Albert the Great's college in Old Baker Street. But this is the kind of magnificent residence, home, house, that your elderly knights, Bali, Commendatore, would have built for himself or for his retinue to live in. It's interesting that in the plans of Casa Correa, you will see that the ground floor, the arcaded doors there, are actually shops, botteghe, which went one part of the way of helping with the maintenance of the house, the revenue that was generated with the rents of the ground floor. Would help, of course, with the maintenance of the house, or certainly with some other form of revenue, even if the owner didn't need it. But a person living in a house like this would walk into a grand entrance, but then go immediately up to the upper floors. The ground floor was inhabited by servants, workmen, craftspeople, and so on. Now, I've just chosen two plans of Casa Correa to show you roughly what I've explained. But now to start focusing a bit more on the description, on the wording, the designations of, given to the rooms themselves. As I've told you already, the lower one, showing the Piano del Mezzanino, the ground floor, shows a series of botteghe. And possibly there's a further, even lower entrance, further down, because we know the level of the road isn't equal. Where the servants would have walked in from. The servants never walked in through the main entrance. And one other aspect that's particularly baroque about this, that shows us something that's particularly baroque about this house, is that from the entrance, one immediately sees the courtyard. There's an interesting relationship happening here between the courtyard and the main entrance. There's a sort of prospettivo being given, with a point of focus at the very end. I don't know if you can make out just a dot over there at the end. That would have been possibly a niche, a sculpture, some subject that would have drawn the viewer's attention immediately. The guest would have walked in. Sorry, you walked into the side. The guest to Casa Correa would have immediately seen now the sense of perspective of an unfolding, enfilade of rooms, one and the other. There would have also been an interesting play of light, thanks to this cortile, the courtyard. But I'll be speaking about the functions of the courtyard later on. On the upper floor, again, very simple descriptions. All we see is camera, a room, a hall, or sala, over there in the middle one. The grand hall, possibly, where maybe visitations would be held or parties would be held. But otherwise, all we have is camera. Chances are they would have been bedrooms. There have been some studies on the interiors of houses, and there's sometimes this notion that, certainly on the continent, that in larger houses, the lady of the house would have her own wing, while the master of the house would have another wing. This isn't the case in Malta. It's very unusual to find houses that are that large to be able to have a sort of the gendering of wings in this way. And for example, even the palace in Valletta can't be gendered for obvious reasons, and the Grand Master didn't have a wife or a family to also live with him. So we don't see this division of spaces very visibly in Malta. It may have happened, but we still need to come across evidence of this. Towards the back of the piano nobile, on the upper part, we see the simple word, gabinetto. Now, before I hear any titters, no, this is not likely that they were simply the bathrooms. I mean, there were no drainage or toilet facilities as we know them today. I think that that's referring to the Italian use of gabinetto, of simply a small room. Now, whether it would be for storage or not, we don't know, but it's very possible that that would be a kind of study space, or possibly an overhang from the 16th century use of the word cabinetto, as in cabinetto di curiosità, a cabinet of curiosities. And more about that very soon. Just one last reference to the images that we see inside, just a quick pointer to this particular house in South Street. It's believed to be in front of the Scots Church. I don't believe it still exists anymore. May have fallen during the war. But it's interesting because it demarcates the entrances. Although both are effectively on the ground floor, there's a different entrance for servants. At the front, you've got the Entrata Nobile, and to the side, you've got the Entrata Rustica. Now, why Rustica should suggest maybe country folk coming in with livestock, or the servants, but there certainly is a separate entrance. Another remarkable thing about Baroque houses, and I'll try and go back maybe I'll stay with this one, is the number of staircases one comes across. And you'll always find either the grand staircase, as grand as the ones at today's Museum of Fine Arts, for example, or a dogleg staircase, a sort of L-shaped one, like the Cathedral Museum. And then you find the garrigor. Again, it's very likely that staircases were differentiated for whether one was the resident of the house or whether one was a servant. But again, we're still guessing at this point. One last thing is the fact that rooms lead one onto each other. In the Baroque period, actually towards the end of the 16th century, we start seeing the development of corridors. We've seen this in the palace. The way the corridors that we know today were constructed happened over time. They weren't an immediate Renaissance addition to the palace. And corridors are really part of now one's procession into a house. That's one thing, and that is in fact the case at the palace. But corridors are also now the part of the house where other collections could be displayed, namely paintings. Okay? Corridors could also double up as gallerie, not gallerie as in balconies as we know today, in Italian use of the word galleria as in gallery. And I'll be speaking about that later on. But what else, what other sources do we have for Maltese houses? Unfortunately, we've got very little pictorial evidence, certainly before the 18th century. This happens to be just a sketch, a drawing, an artist, it's in an album at the Museum of Fine Arts, and the artist may have simply been practicing his single point perspective skills, because as you can see, sort of that sense of depth that's engendered even by the floor tiles, the hard stone floor tiles themselves. But it's worth lingering a little bit on this drawing, and I'm glad I chose it for the poster of this lecture. And it's got the elements that we'll all recognize. That image of staircase with a little sculpture demarcating the points where the stairs start. And the underside of the staircase, sort of that stepped underside that we see in Baroque houses today. But it's also as if though the owner of the house is meant to go immediately straight upstairs, right? Other people, possibly servants or craftspeople, would walk into the left-hand side of this particular house. That gate is rather odd. Colleagues have suggested perhaps that's to keep livestock from walking out. Maybe people kept chickens or, I don't know, perhaps rabbits or goats. But anyway, one can think of little other reason, short of perhaps toddlers escaping to the ground floor. But there's certainly a barrier. But in this case, for pictorial reasons probably, it's open. And it allows us a glimpse now into the distance. And one sees what may seem to be a woman, because it looks like somebody wearing a skirt. So possibly this may indicate that that may be the kitchen at the back of the house. Either the kitchen or perhaps another room, another camera, where some other kind of activity took place. We can also see descending stairs in the middle distance of this sort of long sweep of vista. And that may be leading down to a courtyard. As we know, Valletta's full of hills. The difference in levels must have given architects quite a challenge to work with this sort of levels and meanings in levels of houses. But it also points out to something that appears in other plans, that the courtyard, the cortile, isn't where one would actually walk. The owner of the house, the piano nobile, would have a terrace or a kind of gallery or a loggia coperta where one would enjoy looking down into the courtyard. Anyway, this certainly bears exploring, the relationship between the courtyard and the rest of the house. Other sources of information about the interiors of houses, thankfully we've got Antoine Favret, showing us now how women lived inside their houses and how they occupied their spaces. The first painting on the left, which is in a private collection, but it's illustrated in the Fiorentino de Giorgio book on Antoine Favret, shows a visit, and clearly what's taking place inside a bedroom. Is it a visit to a woman who's just given birth? But this is the closest one comes to some kind of intimation of a gendered space. It's just women here. And if one reads Carmel Cassar's book on the Daughters of Eve, he remarks on how women's lives were really were dealt with exclusively by women. Issues of health, women's health, were sorted out by midwives or by women who had some knowledge of popular medicine. So anyway, this is just one picture that allows us a glimpse now into a gendered space. The other painting, The Visit, by Antoine Favret, also in a way shows how the woman is really the mistress of the house, greeting a friend who's walking up the stairs to visit. But it's also interesting to see now how this particular hall is decorated. And there we see the first intimation of a Maltese collection of art. We've got very few images, I'd say practically none, I think, Francesca, showing Baroque art collections or Baroque collections per se of other things. So I think even with this simple painting, it's a very small painting actually, that Favret created. It's like an A2 size picture, where we're seeing at the lower level two still life paintings of flowers flanking an Arlochta Lira. The next level up, which is sort of, again, a sort of hierarchy of meaning in the way paintings were displayed. The next level up is a portrait of the Grand Master. Could be Pinto, perhaps, or de Rohan. But flanked by two full-length figures, possibly allegories, sort of more noble subjects. We can't make out the bottom We can't make up the painting in the third tier, the uppermost tier, because we just seen the bottom. But one could guess that that is probably some kind of history painting, some noble battle scene, some subject worthy of being at the highest most rank. It's interesting. There is this kind of ranking even in display. And it forms part of the way paintings were displayed already in the early 17th century, this kind of thinking behind the display of paintings. I should add that in my work on the my doctoral thesis, most of my work was conducted in the spolii. The spolii were lists of belongings that knights were obliged to keep, a sort of inventory of their property before they would then pass them on to the Order of St. John. And you'd often get, I was always, of course, looking out for paintings, but you get subject matter coming out in these inventories, and in a way, observing the subject matter allows you to get an insight into the tastes of the person. The most common works of art would be the themes that we're all familiar with. But when you consider the appropriateness of certain themes to certain spaces, you realize that there was even a choice being made in how paintings were displayed, or at least in which rooms they would be displayed. The spolii. Now, the spolii are a fascinating source of information, also about Baroque interiors. And while this might look like an ant took a walk with ink on its feet, I'll let you into a bit more information here. Sometimes you come across inventories where the belongings, where the objects are listed by room. So, for example, in this case, I've circled, the first one would be nell'ingresso della della due prima porta, or another one, l'antisala, the room before the hall, or else next one, nella sala. So even this listing, in a way, walks you through the halls one by one. You can see which room preceded the other. But also, another interesting area of research that's really just asking to be tackled is how the belongings that are listed by each room reflect what went on inside each room. You find different types of furniture, different types of paintings, certainly. This is what I came across in my studies in each room. So that is one big clue as to how those spaces were occupied. But earlier on, I mentioned very briefly the Cabinetto di Curiosità, the Studiolo. Now, in a number of inventories, I came across objects or paintings or small images that suggested cabinets of curiosities. Now, you may have heard of Gabinetto di Curiosità, or else Gabinetto di Antichità, or the German term would be Wunderkammer or Kunstkammer. Referring to now the early 16th century practice of collecting objects. Now, this really started in Italy. We see rooms being set up by great collectors like Isabella d'Este, Federico di Montefeltro. This is in north of Italy. Private rooms, small rooms, studies, with spaces, with cupboards, where collections now of naturalia, flora, things from nature would be collected. Or artifacts, things of wonder, wonderment, strange machines, strange mechanisms, clocks. Okay, so you've got this duality to collections, that of nature and that of artifice. But the whole point of these collections was really to gain knowledge into the natural world. Now, in this case, people like Isabella d'Este and other collectors would have been imitating now the classical, taking the advice of the classical authors, people like Pliny, Vitruvius, and others, where knowledge is to be gained now by observing things empirically. This is the shift now from the the theologically driven world of knowledge of the medieval age to the now the more empirical approach to gaining knowledge, to understanding things experientially, that was heralded with the Renaissance. Now, did we have any studioli in Malta? Well, we probably did. And the clue to that is a 16th century book by a knight, Fra Sabbada Castiglione, who chose to illustrate a book that he wrote with a self-portrait, showing himself inside his studiolo. Now, this book, Ricordi, is really in the line of books of behavior. You may have heard of Il Cortigiano by Baldassare Castiglione, a cousin actually of Fra Sabba, and another one on the education of princes, for example, by Erasmus. There were several books being published showing people how to behave in a noble way. Even if they may have not been noblemen, noble people themselves, they could certainly emulate noble behavior. Aspirational, call it what you will. But a book like Fra Sabba's was intended now for hospitaller knights. The difference, the distinction between Fra Sabba's book and his more famous cousins was that Fra Sabba's was intended for bachelors who lived far away from the court, who lived on the battlefield. Il Cortigiano was intended for courtiers, people who lived in the circle, the immediate circle of a monarch, of a duke, of a king, of a queen, or a princess. So certain codes of behavior would be transmitted in a book like that. But Fra Sabba wrote this book for his young nephew, really. He dedicated it to his young nephew, who's also just joining the order. And it's really a series of chapters, some of them are just one paragraph long, but a series of chapters on advice to his young nephew. Now, I mentioned earlier on the studiolo, the collection. Fra Sabba himself had a collection. By the way, Fra Sabba never came to Malta. He joined the order in Rhodes, and in his letters to Isabella d'Este, no less, he complained about how Philistine, all the other knights were. But he took the opportunity of collecting original Greek classical sculptures to send back to Italy. He was one of the sources of classical, original classical sculptures to be sent back to Italy. But he was soon given a commandery, and he was already in Italy by 1530, before 1530, when the order left Rhodes. But he published this book of advice in the 1550s. So it's a very interesting book because it's a transitional piece of work, again, now from the early Renaissance mode of thinking, that in a way that precedes the Counter-Reformation. But very usefully for us, Fra Sabba has laid out the foundations also for one's intellectual life, the intellectual life of a knight. And in fact, he's chosen to represent himself in his private study, surrounded by books to emulate, to give a sense of his own erudition, but also the escutcheon showing the coat of arms, which of course part of his self-identity is his noble background. But he's also showing himself in the act of writing. So the activity of writing was part now of the expected activity, the activity expected of the virtuous nobleman, especially of the nobleman who joined the Order of St. John. Now, Fra Sabba's book has been studied at great length by historians, especially art historians, because he very obligingly has a chapter called Circa il l'ornare della casa. But, and he starts out saying, "And my dear nephew, I need to give you some advice about works of art, because you're going to rub shoulders with great men who have great collections, so you need to be able to discuss this with them too." So, and then he sort of literally walks his nephew through his own collection, which is a very modest collection, nothing on the magnificent size that we see in some royal collections, but he makes the case, as the classical authors do, that it's quality that matters, that it's pointless having hundreds of works of art if you simply own them without having the time to appreciate them and see the knowledge that they could impart to you. Anyway, so within that context, I think we can safely therefore say that the Hospitaller Order really even brought its own culture to impact on the way collections started taking shape in Baroque Malta. And in fact, let's look at the collection that grew at inside the palace. That started with Grandmaster Verdal. These are watercolors by Jean Houel. You may be more familiar with the engravings that came out of these watercolors. These were published at the end of the 18th century. But the collection of the Grandmasters is one that really started out at the end of the 16th century by Verdal. And Verdal had, we know this from accounts of visitors, that he had a cabinet of precious items, of jewels, of coins, for example, intagli, because all these were objects that, apart from being precious by their very nature, made of gold, silver, whatever, or precious gems, now, they also contained knowledge. Even a simple portrait of a king would be precious information at that time. We must remember, we must keep reminding ourselves that the proliferation of images that we have today gives a completely wrong impression of the range of images that were available to the spectator, to the viewer, in the 16th century. All images were manufactured images, either coins, low relief sculptures, or paintings, and so on. Just as a bit of a reminder about the importance of paintings as knowledge, for the transmission of knowledge. Now, when it came to cabinets, especially of curiosities, one didn't necessarily have to have everything. It was impossible to amass a sample, a specimen of everything. So, again, it was the quality that mattered, but one needed to strive to compile, to bring together as many good pieces as possible. So, this is the Hospitaller side of collecting. Further north, there was another author, if you like, talking about collections. And this 16th century author actually published his work too. This is Samuel de Kischeberg, who was a sort of proto-librarian. But he started out first sort of classifying the potions in a pharmacist's spezzeria. But he went on then to create classifications for cabinets of curiosity. And he's the first one now to set out the different inscriptions, the different classes of objects within which a collection had to be organized. Now, Kischeberg was hoping that with a book like this, this would be his passport to be engaged on working on a major collection. It didn't transpire that way, but unfortunately he died within 2 years of the publication. But from what we know about other collections of curiosities, it's highly likely that the knowledge that he published, of course, this information that he published, was also shared not only by German princes, and certainly in the Bavarian area, but even by the Medici in Florence. Now, it wasn't enough, as we'll see, it wasn't enough to simply amass things. They needed to be organized to be of any useful purpose. And Kischeberg is one person now who gives these classifications. Natural things, things from the sea, and so on. I'm not going to go into the actual classifications themselves, but it's often been thought that, with respect to collections, that these were started out by kings or monarchs. It transpires, now from other information that we have, thanks to this book, that in effect, for example, Prince Albert, who Kischeberg hoped would be his patron, was actually imitating merchant collectors in aspiring to build up his collection. He's precisely imitating the Fuggers, who we know as merchants, gold merchants, in south and south of Bavaria. So this is sort of reversing, okay, the role that we've always imagined of collections being started out in terms of establishing the magnificence of a ruler. Whereas in effect now, rulers were actually imitating people who had probably greater means at their disposal, greater wealth to spend on building up collections. But even actually when you think about it, the people who needed this kind of knowledge of other lands, for example, of things from strange distant countries, for example, would be merchants. People who needed to know more about the rest of the world that they would hope to explore or maybe have dealings, commercial dealings with, will actually be people who worked. Now, what would a collection of curiosities serve to a prince, a ruler? And this is the other thing about Kesheberg. He makes a case for a collection of objects, man-made objects and of natural objects, as a sort of proto-research center, building up a magnificent collection to help the prince and the people around him now to become more virtuous through becoming more knowledgeable and therefore being better rulers amongst their own people. So this is sort of the beginnings now of a collection as actually being intended for research purposes. It's actually rather later, with the beginning of the 17th century, that collections start to get opened up to a wider public, where the notion of magnificence and grandeur and splendor now become part of the narrative of collections. I haven't got a picture here, but you may be familiar with those paintings by Teniers of showing Archduke Ferdinand in his private gallery, showing four triple-decker arrangements of paintings, where it's clearly the spectator simply meant to be wowed into being impressed at the size of the collection, apart from the quality of the works of art themselves. In Malta, we had our very own person, erudite person, trying to organize knowledge that one had about Malta. And I'm talking about Gianfrancesco Abela. Now, in his book, Della Descrizione di Malta, 1647, Abela has a very clear agenda. He's trying to show the history of Malta, but in connection with the narrative of the Old Testament and the New Testament, or else in connection with the more recent history of the island itself. But Nathaniel Cotillard has pointed out in one of his essays how it's rather charmingly, because it was so uselessly really, rather charmingly, Abela tries to link the objects that he has collected, including the fantastic objects that certainly didn't exist, like that creature, the lower bottom right, somehow weaving them into this narrative. It's as though Abela is, like other collectors, authors in mainland Europe, are trying to link now the material evidence with the texts that have come down from the medieval period. Sort of, sometimes there'd be a clear mismatch, but this is the agenda, the project, that a collector like Gianfrancesco Abela undertook. Abela, too, may have been aware of the possibilities of his collection as being a research collection, because at his death he bequeathed it to the Jesuits College. And it so happens that with the expulsion of the Jesuits from Malta and their property becoming state property, taken over by the Order of St. John, in time it became now the basis for the beginnings of the National Museum. So, rather interestingly, probably completely unexpectedly for Abela's intentions, these original artifacts are still existing down to this very day. In fact, by the way, that sculpture of Hercules, which he describes as Il nostro Ercole Maltese, is still in the collection at the National Museum of Archaeology. So there's this emphasis now on private collections. Now, these would have been kept inside one's home. We're not yet talking about public spaces. The only people who would have seen these would have been guests of Gianfrancesco Abela, of the collector. Very few people would have had access to the studiolo, right, before collections went public into corridors and so on. They would be like-minded people who would be equally interested in sharing knowledge about the latest manuscript or book that they just read, for example. Again, was this a gendered space or not? We don't know. But these were private activities. So who are we to say that no women weren't educated enough to appreciate this? Certainly, this was also the time of the build-up of fantastic collections of books. In spite of the prohibition of the index of prohibited books, if anybody reads any essay relating to the collection of books at the National Library, essays Carmen de Pasquale has written about them, Maroma Camilleri, you see hundreds of books about quite a range of subjects. Now, most of them are from hospitaller libraries. So perhaps understandably, the area of interest would be geographical, an understanding of topographies of other lands. Don't forget, these were military men. Occasionally you find other books by Greek philosophers, texts, Renaissance published texts of Greek philosophers, particularly the Stoics. The Stoics surface now in hospitaller culture, and that's an area of research entirely of its own. Another picture, a painting, an illusionistic painting of a cabinet, of an actual literal cabinet of curiosities. But I think it's fair enough to say that this is the way cabinets would be packed with interesting things. Now, it must have been fascinating to actually come across a cabinet like this, and you know, letting your eyes stroll over things from all over the world, things that of different materials, supplemented by the odd picture, or medals or so on. Strange things like coral. You've spoken about coral, haven't you, Francesca? Anyway, so, and several of us, in a way, can, I believe, have an empathy for this kind of collecting. The pebble picked up from the beach, the souvenir from the country we've just visited. This is really a practice that continues to this very day. And in a way, compiling collections like this are really about the fabrication of identity, really. An identity based on memories, on stories that are borne witness to by these very things themselves. Things from different countries, from different spaces, things with different stories to tell, but only brought together under the roof of that particular collector. So there's a uniqueness there to cabinets of curiosities that is, it's an area of research actually that artists are engaging with these days. The way they're bringing together objects and installations to create a personal narrative. But anyway, that's contemporary art. In Malta, the Museum of Fine Arts, we've got these little cabinets with beautifully inlaid with ivory, but with drawers where one would keep coins, medals, small precious gems, intagli, for example, and other things. So, in its own way, even the cabinets, the housing itself, where collections were kept, you know, were enticing enough, would sort of lead you to want to open a drawer, but of course, one would only be able to do so with the permission of the collector. I mentioned earlier, paintings as knowledge. At the National Collection, we've also got this very modest picture, hasn't had been given much attention, but it shows the yucca plant. And the inscription at the bottom, Fiore Americano, chiamato yucca, regalato al Bali, dal Bali Belmont, al Gran Maestro Rohan in 1786. Apart from the interesting narrative of gift-giving, by the way, which is, again, a story of its own, this is, again, one way of how pictures portrayed could create knowledge. Seeing is understanding, and seeing is believing as well. Keep in mind the 18th century was the age of enlightenment, where we, at the National Library, for example, at the moment, there's this magnificent book that's on display, it's just been restored, showing botanical illustrations. Again, this need to classify, this need to create knowledge, thanks to image making, is squarely an 18th century activity, but it has its roots in the beginnings of collections of the late 16th century. With respect to art collections and the way they were displayed inside houses, one last source that I need to mention today is a text that was never actually published. It was always handed around in manuscript form, written by Giulio Mancini, the physician, the doctor, Giulio Mancini, in 1614. Now, we know Mancini better for his biography, his biographical work on Caravaggio. He's regularly quoted because he's one of the handful of people who actually met the artist. But Mancini, his work is much more valuable than that, and it's only starting to be discussed and uncovered within the context of the role of art, the therapeutic role of art in a nobleman's life. One section that we have to deal with now is he discussed art collections that he saw. The cardinal, as a physician, by the way, as a hugely trusted physician, he was often entrusted into the private chambers of grand men, usually, cardinals, the Pope himself, and bishops and so on. So he had the possibility of observing major collections and the way they were displayed. And Mancini, in his manuscripts, lays out the need for symmetry, for having a large central painting then flanked in a symmetrical way by paintings in smaller sizes. Mancini also talks about the appropriateness of certain subject matter to certain rooms. For example, portraits were to be kept inside the main hall for one's visitors to see and admire one's ancestors, of course. Interestingly, Mancini also goes on about landscape paintings. And he emphasizes how viewing the landscape, the natural landscape, or by default, viewing the painted landscape, had its therapeutic value. People in the time were believed to suffer from the humors, melancholy, for example. And Mancini wrote about how walking in the landscape, in a natural landscape, could help to alleviate one's melancholy. But he also goes on about saying how then it can be replicated in one's own house by means of corridors or galleries where one would display works of art. So this is where we see now this particularly Baroque space called the corridor, the passeggiatore, the corridoio or galleria, where one would be encouraged to walk up and down and take exercise. By the way, he goes on a lot about walking as exercise. But at the same time, seeing things, paintings particularly, to give one pleasure and to restore one's good humor. And he specifies landscape for that, which now leads me on to gardens. And this is the last bit that I have to say, and I'm drawing to a close very soon. The Magistral Palace was one of the few palaces, one of the few spaces in Valletta that had its own garden. We're seeing it up there, and here we can see a close-up on the left. The palace once had a Renaissance garden. The picture on the left is actually 18th century. It's the one on the right that we need to see for its Renaissance values. The way the garden is divided into quadripartite spaces, and even those spaces themselves are divided yet again geometrically. Was this a herb garden? Was this a floral garden? Was this a garden for specimen of different flora and fauna? We don't know. What we have is this picture from an album that's really an album that concerns the mechanisms that brought water into Valletta. But rather obligingly, the engineer himself also included this layout of the garden of the palace itself. Now, we also need to keep in mind that there wasn't just the space of the garden or the plants growing. There were other things happening that we have no clue of today, but they certainly were there. And these were now the appeals to the senses. The scents, the wonderful smells that came out from the, you know, from the flowers of the herbs themselves. Or another aspect that's hardly touched upon in history is the role of pets in the Baroque house. I've only come across two suggestions of pets in the Baroque house. We know, for example, that the Grand Master had an aviary on the piano nobile, a massive collection of birds, fantastic and exotic birds, so we can just imagine the sounds that they gave off. I also know then, we can also guess from the few paintings that we see of animals as pets. For example, recently we've seen an essay by Giovanni Bonello on monkeys kept as pets. But we know little about them. We also know a bit about falconry, pets or not. But certainly the lives, the meaning or the utility of knowledge about animals is something that we haven't even started looking at. Now, I mentioned that the palace was one of the few houses, buildings with the right to have a garden inside Valletta. This is a private house, Palazzo Sieges, that is now the offices of a group of lawyers in Valletta and Straight Street. And it's interesting because of the multiple layers of terraces that it has. Now, courtyards were quite small. There would be no way one could actually have a garden. At best, one could have a tree in a very large pot, which wasn't because of water problems, because every house had its well. But the water was still precious and had to be kept for consumption by inhabitants. This is why gardens weren't actually encouraged inside Valletta. But this terrace is interesting because it's the type of space where your noble person, the nobleman, noble woman, their children, would take a walk inside their own house. Now, with the Baroque house in Malta, we've got two types of spaces, the uncovered space, because we can enjoy being in the outdoors, but even the loggia coperta. And maybe you might have noticed in one or two other plans that I showed earlier that you get this indication of a loggia coperta, which would allow a person to walk and appreciate one's courtyard without necessarily getting wet. The Grand Master himself had another garden to enjoy, and that was the Giardino della Marina. And that was a magnificent garden. We can't see it anymore. But my eye was taken by those three or four rooms that were to be found in the lower part of this particular drawing. And from an account, from a description that was part of this album, we know that this was where the Grand Master also had a gallery of paintings. And I quote, Il giardino della Marina è diviso in due parti, nella prima piantata da grumi e sta nella fossa del recinto della città Valletta con bellissima fontana. Da questo si possa passare un altro giardino piantato da grumi ed in capo vi è altra bellissima fontana. Ed infine del medesimo si passa in una bellissima galleria tappezzata e mobiliata, dove Sua Eccellenza goda il fresco dell'estate e guarda la bella vista del porto. And here we come full circle to what Mancini had said in 1614 of enjoying the landscape, but even enjoying one's own collection and taking pleasure in viewing those paintings. And on this note, I'll end this talk. Thank you very much. You've been, the attention from you has been really coming forth nicely. As I said earlier on, I'm just touching upon the subject. I made a point of giving you the sources, and hopefully one or two of you may choose to take the baton and carry on walking down one particular alleyway of research. Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa, for this fascinating lecture, which has not only explored the architecture of the Baroque house, but also looked at the building of Upper Vaught collections, their display within the houses, and aspects of the social history and in the domestic life of the 17th and 18th centuries. We have 5 minutes or 10 minutes for questions, if any of you have questions.
You showed us a sketch towards the end of the Salone of the Bali de Prete. Is there any more information you have about it?
That would be wonderful if one had more information, even about the collection itself. This drawing was first published by Kichi Baras in his book on Baroque sculpture, where he spoke about the importance of the order's ambassadors in Rome. But this is really one of the rare insights we have into a hospitaller space. And really, it emphasizes the fact that hospitaller knights were cultured in their own way. This notion of men who were just out to fight, were just out to sort of... Well, that made the news, as it would, you know, the dueling, the fighting, the killing, the bad behavior. But other knights, more well-off knights, and even not necessarily so well-off knights, also chose to create another self-identity in a way that subverted this militant image. This self-identity as an educated person, an erudite person, almost sort of turning upside down the whole notion of the hospitaller knight as one, a thug, just out for a fight. And paintings, of course, were part of it. Because paintings weren't simply about magnificence and splendor. We know enough about that. But they were also the occasion for narratives, for moments of storytelling, explanations about the content of a painting, how that painting arrived in one's on collection, certainly the rivalry in acquiring certain pieces. We do know, for example, at the beginning of the 17th century, there was this great sale of the century with the dispersal of the collection of Charles I in London. And the kings in Spain were fighting with, had their own spies trying to negotiate directly to acquire the fabulous works of art that had already been. The Titians, for example, that Charles I had acquired now from the sales of the d'Este collection. The lineage of paintings, their pedigree, is a story in its own right.
The painting over there is, in a way, very representative of aristocratic houses anywhere in Europe at the time. I can quote, for example, a very glaring example, which is Palazzo Colonna in Rome. In Palazzo Colonna in Rome, you get exactly that type of arrangement of paintings. But there was something even more significant in these Baroque houses, actually, that normally it was an expression of ego, actually. For example, if the house belonged to an important person who had taken part in an important battle, you're going to get probably somewhere a fresco of that battle. For example, in the Palazzo Colonna in Rome, you get the Battle of Lepanto, because Marco Antonio Colonna was one of the commanders of the Allied fleet. Now, this was something which happens again and again in these Baroque interiors, and this is perhaps one of the motivating reasons why the main contribution in housing in the Baroque age was that for the first time architects started becoming conscious of the specialization of space, which did not exist before. In the medieval house, a space was used for a variety of purposes. It could be a dining room, it could be a place for relaxation. There was no special concept of specialized space. But in the Baroque, for the first time, because of this need of expressing the ego of the owners of the palaces or houses, you get this concept of the specialization of space. And this is a great contribution of the Baroque age to palace building, actually.
Thank you very much, Teresa. It was just, actually, what was just said just now made me think about the whole question of continuity, because you mentioned in the beginning that these houses actually were used by the knights, but not necessarily transmitted. In other words, they were actually passed on to different people who inhabited them. Now that seems to me is one reason why, on the one hand, you have a continuity of form, but not so much of content. In other words, much less so what was just mentioned over here of people leaving their imprint in the sense of the within the accoutrements and display of the house, because it was perhaps redistributed afterwards.
In fact, we know of art markets that developed in Malta, that grew in Malta at the beginning of the 17th century. The Order of St. John brought Italian auctioneers to organize the sale, the dispersal of the belongings of the knights themselves. And it's actually those moments of auctions, those viewings, when Maltese people now had the opportunity of seeing the type of belongings inside one's house, or the types of paintings. And that's also the moment when works of art would also then find their way into Maltese households. With respect to those knights who would then move into the probably empty house, there was also the possibility of leasing. In the spogli, I've come across instances, Brancaccio, for example, Fra Brancaccio, leased about 183 paintings from the Duca di Rospigliosi, precisely to furnish one of his houses. This is one of those fabulous collections you find in the spogli. But this is a moment, the sale is a moment of transition of values. But continuity, Paul, very interestingly, and in a way, you're bringing me back to why we're inside Palazzo Santa Sofia. I believe if we're going to look at continuity of collections, if those collections still exist from possibly even the medieval period, chances are they are in Imdina. Because Imdina was the seat, if you like, of noble families, with connections overseas, who knew perfectly well how one was meant to behave in the company of great men, for example, Palazzo Falzon. Quick panic, 1530, Matteo Falzon had to furnish his house here to be able to greet Grandmaster Lila Dam, as befitted the occasion. And dozens of mules were needed to bring things over from Burgu, for example. We just know that one instance, but it's the exception that proves the rule, that was the established mode of behavior, and that was the established mode of furnishing one's house in Imdina. But the difficulty for researchers is that we're talking again about private spaces, private properties, so it's not that easy for us to gain further knowledge now about the types of collections, the type of things people furnish their houses with, the types of collections that they sort. But certainly, if there's continuity, it's in here. It's in this town.
Okay, I think we'll bring this session to a close. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you again, Teresa. This was the last in a series of lectures organized by the Baroque Institute this season. It will continue again. The series of lectures will continue again in October. If you're interested in knowing more about the lectures, please give your name or your details to Andrea De Battista, who's sitting here, and be happy to receive them from you after the lecture. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to Professor De Lucca for helping to organize this lecture. And thank you very much especially to Palazzo Falzon and to Francesca Balzan for hosting this event over here. Thank you for everyone for coming, for your participation. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falzon entitled The Baroque House and the World Within. This talk was delivered by Dr. Therese Vella.